From the Meridian Manufacturing Studios, you're listening to Inside Agriculture on this Monday. While trade deals are heating up the presidential campaigns and making it more likely a new administration and a new Congress may decide the fate of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and leading GOP contender Donald Trump were all now negative on trade, including the TPP agreement that American Farm Bureau said could bring $5 billion in new exports for agriculture. Longtime Washington, D.C.-based trade consultant Paul Drasek says, however, the candidates' positions are less about trade and more about politics.
What politics in general have in the election politics on both sides of the aisle, where they stand at the point in time when there's a vote on TPP, will have more to do with the actual final vote count.
With trade leaders in Congress now taking a go-slow approach in the debate over filling a Supreme Court vacancy, TPP may end up waiting until after a new Congress and administration are seated. Drasek says at that time, local politics can override national politics.
If a member of Congress in Missouri, for example, decides which way they're going to vote, it's going to be based on what the constituents think about this and whether the constituents that vote for them think about it much more so than where Hillary is on it.
The 12-member countries reached an agreement on the trade deal last fall and signed the TPP last month. It must still be ratified by the governments of each nation included in the deal. Also in agriculture news, Canada's agriculture minister, Lawrence McCauley, is encouraging China to stick to scientific facts as the country toughens standards for canola shipments. Pro Farmers First Thing Today reports China's quarantine authority last month alerted Canada it would allow canola shipments to contain no more than 1% of foreign material beginning April 1st versus the current allowable range between 2% and 2.5%. While China says the change is due to concerns about the back leg fungus, many speculate that the change is more about slowing imports of the crop. And you're listening to Inside Agriculture on 910 Classic Country, KCJB in Minot, as well as Ag News 890 and Farm and Country, Thunder 106.1 in Lisbon and Fargo, North Dakota. As we mentioned before we took the break, we'll talk GMOs, and with the debate over the future of GMO labeling in the Senate, every person in the agricultural industry is being challenged to rise up.
We've got to stop this because it's going to cost the consumer a lot of money, it's going to cost the farmer a lot of money, and in the end, it takes us back toward the dark ages. I really like to say in this fight that analogy is it, I say, you know, back in the old days, they said the earth was flat, and people kept saying the earth was flat, but you know, it wasn't. Well, they keep saying GMOs are bad, but they're not. So we're going to get out there, we're going to get people. They need to call in. They need to get on the website.
That's Wade Cowan, chairman of the American Soybean Association and a farmer producer from Texas. He says this is far too important an issue to leave simply to chance. Farmers just have to pick up the phone.
It's 866-464-6633. Or they can go to the website, which is cfsaf.org, which is Center for Safe, Affordable Food. It's just those initials, and you can go to that, and you'll get directions on how to send an email. But what I'd really encourage everybody to do is when you hear this, take the time. Unless you're driving, get on the number, make the call, and like I said earlier, do it like a Chicago voter. Do it early and often.
And that phone number again is 866-464-6633. That's 866-464-6633. While DTN Progressive Farmer Meteorologist Bryce Anderson told farmers at the Illinois Soybean Summit on Friday, weather would cap this year's potential yields. Now, Todd Gleason talks with Anderson. He asks if he means it's unlikely for yields to be better than USDA's trend line.
Yeah, I think that's right, Todd, because we're going to, in all likelihood, have a pretty wet spring in much of the eastern Corn Belt, south into the Gulf Coast and the southeast. We're already seeing that. So I think a wetter spring with planting delays is going to be a part of that. And then a cool temperature trend. So that, you know, that doesn't do crops a whole lot of good getting started. Then in the summertime, we're going to see a warmer to hotter temperature pattern than we've seen the last 2 years, along with variable precipitation. Illinois is going to kind of be on both sides of the precip trend. And I, with those kind of environmental hurdles to work with, so to speak, I think that that's going to take its toll on how crops perform this year.
Is the bulk of that coming up front for you in terms of what the top end looks like? So it's the wet spring that causes the problem for the top end of the range?
Yeah, I think it is. We've seen that that, you know, when we have problems getting crops planted on time, that it definitely shows up in performance. And, you know, unfortunately, last year, 2015, really proved that out here in Illinois, where the areas in the central and eastern part of the state that got so wet had a definitely lower corn production result than areas that were able to at least get their crop planted by June.
What's your thought about South America for the coming growing season? Not for the one that's being harvested now, but for the 2016-17 growing season. I know it's a very long way out.
Well, the Pacific is moving away from a very strong El Nino, and it is more and more likely that when we get into September, October, and then on through the balance of this year, that the Pacific waters are going to cool enough that La Nina takes over. When La Nina is in effect, that is a definitely drier weather maker for Argentina and southern Brazil. And I think that we're going to have an issue with crop weather in South America this coming year that, you know, kind of takes them away from being able to repeat some of the terrific production that they're coming out with now.
Bryce, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Todd.
Bryce Anderson is with DTN Progressive Farmer.
I'm Todd Gleason.
Well, when we talk what's going on inside agriculture, a little national news for the most part always. USDA says Secretary Tom Vilsack is going to travel with President Obama to Cuba later this month. That trip will be the first visit by a sitting U.S. president in nearly 90 years to Cuba. The island country sits just 90 miles off the coast of Florida. This will be Secretary Vilsack's second trip to Cuba. In November last year, Vilsack led a delegation of U.S. government officials traveling to Havana in the interest of strengthening bilateral agricultural engagement. Now, during his visit in November, Vilsack met Cuban leadership along with farmers. USDA says Vilsack will use this second trip to Cuba to discuss opportunities for collaboration in agriculture among the United States and Cuba to better understand how climate change is affecting agricultural production in Cuba and continue to help American businesses interested in exporting to Cuba. The Obama administration will announce more easing of trade and travel restriction on Cuba March 17th. The president will then travel to Cuba March 21st. Also, creating sustainable food systems is the greatest challenge of our time. Our Green Revolution, says a JBS leader who has sat at the head of the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. Bob Severa has more in this report.
Cameron Brewitt says, to feed a world population of 9 billion people by 2050, everyone in the protein supply chain must do more with less.
If you look at a lot of the marketing and advertising in agriculture, you would think that sustainability is a niche industry, that it is organic, that it is natural, that it is grass-fed, that it is local. And what it actually means is responsibly meeting the needs of today so that the next generation has an opportunity to responsibly meet their needs tomorrow. In its most simplest terms, sustainability is doing more with less. It's being more efficient. and also being responsible along that journey. And so to think that any one way of producing a product is what's going to satisfy the entire planet is folly.
Brewitt says sustainability includes three main areas: environmental, economic, and social. Many cattle producers already incorporate sustainable practices into their operations, and it's important to share that narrative.
So one of the things that I would do is I would look at my operation and I would think about the economic benefits that my operation is providing just by being in that community. What are the opportunities for my children to stay on that ranch and become a part of helping to meet this great challenge of our time, right? What am I doing in animal welfare, environmental, things that I probably just do as a matter natural course of business? What am I doing in these areas? And how do I articulate that to people who might be interested?
Brewitt says developing a positive story surrounding the U.S. beef industry will ultimately win the day with consumers.
Talk more about the good things that we're doing so that when people who already love the products that we produce and have no intention of not consuming it, that they can continue to feel good about it.
Brewitt spoke at the 2016 Cattle Industry Convention. You can read more at Angus Journal coverage from that presentation at angus.media. I'm Bob Cervera.
Well, as we wrap up what's going on inside agriculture, before we took the break, mentioned the fact about a big loss in money from one state. According to a study conducted by the Washington Council on International Trade, last year's West Coast port slowdown cost the state of Washington $769.5 million in economic activity. Now, it's estimated that $555.8 million worth of exports were not shipped during the six-month slowdown, while business spent an additional $152.6 million on air freight shipments. WCIT President Eric Shinfield says they're concerned another port slowdown or work stoppage could occur after the current five-year contract expires.
And the reason we released this study now, 1 year later on the anniversary of the contract resolution, is it would be so easy for folks to move on. There are so many other things on people's minds. We've got to keep this issue at the forefront, make sure that both sides, labor and management, continue to have conversations, that our elected officials continue to stay engaged, and make sure this does not happen again.
Shinfield adds many don't appreciate the ripple from last year's slowdown is still being felt in the agriculture community.
Things don't just sort of immediately pop back to life as soon as that contract is negotiated. You've got lost long-term contracts, long-term sales. People have been laid off that don't get rehired right away. This is an issue we've got to make sure it doesn't happen again.
And, of course, when it comes to more agriculture news, we mentioned the fact General Mills is planning more than double organic acreage the company uses to source ingredients. Company leaders now expect to meet its goal of 250,000 organic acres by 2019. General Mills said the increased acreage is directly linked to the company's goals to grow net sales from its natural and organic products. The company expects organic sales to reach $1 billion by 2019, a full year ahead of its target. General Mills has increased the organic acreage it supports by 120% since 2009. That's what's going on inside agriculture. I'm Farm Director Terry Loomis.